Hello, everyone. Great to be here today, even though it's kind of cold and blustery. But it's great to be here, not anywhere else. Today I want to talk about, the Abraham covenant that he made with Abraham, that God made with Abraham, and how this covenant was passed down to our very time, passed down actually through right of birth. And, of course, birthright is the right of inheritance, and it in ancient times, and even today, I guess sometimes, it goes to the firstborn son just by right of birth, unless unusual circumstances prevail, which they sometimes do. And let's turn to Genesis 12, verse 1. We all know this, but but repetition is sometimes a good thing. And this is God talking to Abram. In verse 1, chapter 12, verse 1, the Lord said to Abram, "Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land that I will show you." And, you know, it's quite a statement to make to someone, you know, just up and leave and go to a strange place. He says, "I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and curse them. And whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." And we know that this covenant gets enhanced in more detail throughout the rest of the Bible. But this is what it started with. "And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." Quite a statement. And we understand that the earth has, all people on earth has been blessed through this covenant. Because Jesus Christ was born a human of the tribe of Judah and in the an ancestor of King David. And he's also a king, King of Kings. And through his birth and life and death on the cross, of course, all people have been blessed. But there's more to the story when you get into some of the details. We know that this great promise was passed down from Abraham to Isaac, his firstborn. Actually, he had a son before that, but with his wife's Egyptian slave maiden. And he would have been content to give those blessings to Isaac, but God said no. Or give them to Ishmael, rather. But God said no, you'll have a son. You and Sarah will have a son. So the blessing was passed to Isaac through right of birth. And then it was also passed to Jacob. And there was a little bit of going on there. You know, he wasn't born first. But anyway, he ended up with the birthright. It was a little bit of unusual circumstance we don't have time to go into. But where did the birthright go after that? I think that's something that's a little bit of a mystery. It shouldn't be a mystery, but I think a lot of people don't realize what about the birthright. And is it even important? Because Christ was born through the tribe of Judah. That was when Isaac was growing old, he called all of his sons together to give them their blessing, what would happen to them in the future. And of course, Judah received the what you'd call the scepter blessing. The kings, line of kings would come through him, even the Messiah through him. And all nations would be blessed through him. But the birthright didn't go to Judah. And you might say, well, who did it go to? Well, his firstborn son was Reuben. But let's turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 5. And I guess verse 1. And here it's speaking of Reuben. And well, speaking of the sons of Reuben, verse 1, the sons of Reuben, and Reuben, the firstborn of Israel. And you might say, well, why Israel? Well, Jacob's name had been changed to Israel at this point, before this. So Reuben was the firstborn of Israel. And here it has in parentheses, he was the firstborn. But when he defiled his father's marriage bed, his rights as firstborn were given, not to Judah, but given to the sons of Joseph. Also the son of Israel. Joseph was the favorite son of Israel. But the birthright went to the sons of Joseph, Israel's grandsons. In verse 2 it says, and though Judah was the strongest of his brothers and rulers came from him, the rights of the firstborn belonged to Joseph. And how important is that? I think it turned out to be pretty important. And for one thing, it confirms that the Word of God is true, and it goes down through all ages as truth. And let's read a little bit about those two sons. Well, they were grandsons of Israel that received this blessing. Go to Genesis 48. In verse 5, Genesis 48, verse 5, and here Jacob, or Israel, was talking to his son Joseph. He said, now then, your two sons, born to you in Egypt, before I came to you, will be reckoned as mine. So here he's adopting his grandsons as his sons. Ephraim and Manasseh will be mine, just as Reuben and Simeon are mine. Any children born to you after them will be yours. And down in verse 16, it says, the angel, he continues speaking, the angel who has delivered me from all harm, may he bless these boys. May they be called by my name. So here he's naming his name, which is Israel, on these two boys. And the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and may they greatly increase upon the earth. And that was the promise that was given, the birthright promise. Part of that was great wealth, great numbers, populations, nations, and also great military might, and possess the gate of their enemies. Many great blessings. And so he went to bless them, and of course he crossed his hands to put his right hand on the younger one's head for whatever reason. That was the way God wanted it, I'm sure. Well, Joseph didn't want it that way. He said, no, verse 18, no, my father, this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He too will become a people, and he too will become great. Nevertheless, his younger brother will be greater than he, and his descendants will become a group of nations. In other places, it talks about Ephraim becoming a group of nations, a company of nations, and Manasseh becoming a great nation. And we've talked about this before, and when you look at that in the modern world, it's pretty obvious who those nations are today, is the British Empire and America. But again, what is the importance of this birthright promise? How did it help anything? How did it help? Well, we know that Jesus, the Messiah, came in the line of the Jews. He was a Jew by, you know, blood birth, and a descendant of David. And he performed what he came to perform, lived the perfect life, was crucified for our sins. And he... Well, in John chapter 1:29, we can go there. I was just going to talk about it, but we'll go there. John 1:29. here is John the Baptist. He was baptizing and he looked up. The next day John saw Jesus coming toward him. And he said, "Look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." And that's what Christ did. He took away the sin of the world. And all the early Christians, just about all the early Christians, were Jewish. But that didn't last. It eventually broadened out and more Gentiles came in. And the Jewish influence waned very much. And of course, the Jews didn't accept the Messiah. They didn't proclaim him to the world, you know. Also, Acts 4 and 12, we don't need to turn there. I think we all know it. It makes the statement that no other name under heaven, only Christ, no other name can you be saved. You have to accept Christ as your Savior. Well, the Jews never proclaimed that to the world. They never, of course, they didn't accept Christ, and they didn't proclaim that message to the world. But when we look at fairly modern history, and these birthright nations, British Empire, and especially America, have done so much to make the world safe through the might, through the armed might, through the wealth, through the power. They made it safe for personal freedoms. They made it safe for Christians to proclaim this word to the world. You know, without that, when the world is ruled by tyrants, the word, you may have Christians in the world, but they've got their head down. They're not proclaiming much because they would be arrested or killed. But only in the environment where you have a great nation that can stand up and protect those rights and allow that word to go out. And it has gone out. And I'm sure there's still more to be done. But millions upon millions of Judeo-Christian Bibles printed and distributed, missionary work all over the world. And not just us. I'm sure the British people and the empire have done things too. But those birthright nations made it possible for that word to go out. And also, too, there was other blessings. We've protected people around the world. We've, with the blood of our soldiers, and fed people that were starving, and clothed people, and done many things. So truly, through the birthright and through Christ and the Jews, they have been a blessing throughout the world in many ways. And
and when we understand this issue, we'll understand a lot of the things that you see in the writings of the Apostle Paul. It has to do with meat offered to idols. And once we understand it, we'll be able to decipher much of what Paul writes to us. And it will help us to understand the New Testament letters. And of course, we are the New Testament church. The letters were written to us. Thank you, Don. I want to give you an overview of 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10. And then we'll look at it a little more deeply. And I'll have to give some commentators credit. The overview finally struck me. I thought, a lot of people might find this interesting. Some in Corinth were afraid to eat the meat because it had been offered to idols. Many also had an emotional attachment to idolatry and its pagan symbols and atmosphere and statues. And probably the music, food, temple prostitutes, and the symbolic bread, the whole bit. And other people knew that it was nothing. You know, there is no such thing as Aphrodite, Zeus, Saturn, and all those other pagan gods, you know, from the Greek pantheon. They knew it was absolutely nothing. It's just artwork. And Paul gave up his right to be supported by the Corinthian church, which is a big deal. I mean, think about it. Like if someone said to you, "I want you to go to Australia for several years and do a very time-intensive evangelistic campaign and build churches through that area, but you're going to have to find a job in Australia, do whatever you can do. You have to make your own way while you do it." You'd be like, "Whoa, that's a lot harder than I thought." And he has some people with him he had to help support as well. And Paul gave up that salary for the sake of the gospel. And he's telling them there's a principle here that I want all of you to understand. So we're going to go to 1 Corinthians 8 and understand the principle. Paul gave up a salary, and he's telling them they should be willing to give up certain things regarding meat and idols for the sake of the, and I know the term weaker brethren is maybe somewhat debatable. They might not have been weaker in willpower, but they're weaker in knowledge and understanding, the ones who are pickier. 1 Corinthians 8, verse 1. But understanding this, I think, will help us understand the Apostle Paul and a lot of things we see in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians 8, 1. Now, concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge, but knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. He's kind of making the two things, you know, knowledge puffs you up, makes you vain, you know, like puffing up a balloon, where if you use love, which edifies, love builds up like one brick after another brick after another brick. One builds people up and the other one puffs people up. He's using a contrast so the ones who have the knowledge won't get, well, you got to stay humble. You know, as Peter says, you got to be clothed in humility. Verse 4, 1 Corinthians 8, 4. Therefore, concerning eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and there is no other god but one. So you know that Zeus and Venus and Isis and Astarte, and those are all the different names for the female consort, and all the other ones like Mercury, all those pagan gods are nothing. Verse 7 and 8. However, there is not in everyone that knowledge. And some, with the consciousness of the idol, until now eat it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. I'm going to try to picture how that probably worked. Let's say you got converted in the Corinthian church, and you spend the first 40 years of your life in idolatry. And in your mind, you were convicted that there's one creator God, and the Bible is his word, and you know various things that you learn. But emotions are tricky. Actually, they have got academic theories called emotional attachment theory, where companies actually try to attach emotions to brands. And at least as far as some brands, it's been proven. Even in an illogical way, some people love Coke. It's actually been proven. I know you're going to say, but it's just a sweet drink in a can. I'm telling you, when you remove the label, they respond much different. They have, and companies, of course, like that, get you attached to their brand. I think it's true of Tide as well and others, and possibly some car companies. We can argue that a little bit. But in religion, I can see it happening. You spent 40 years of your life, and I'm sure they had their own music and drums beating, you know, things we know about idolatry and the atmosphere and certain bread shaped a certain way. And I'm sure they had a good time, and they jumped and danced and all that pagan stuff. And you had that all of your life. And when you ate that lamb dedicated to Astarte, it had a certain meaning. Same with the bread. Now, maybe your logical mind tells you it's nothing, but that emotional attachment was not going to go away right away. How many years would it take? I don't know, but obviously Paul hadn't converted them all that many years in the past. Some still had it. And if they ate meat they thought was went before an idol, it was like they were back into the whole idolatrous atmosphere. And that's what Paul says. Until now, they eat it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. But food does not commend us to God. Neither will we eat, are we the better or the worse. By the way, I'm not going to read the verse, but if you go to Acts 19, 34 and 35, as Paul's ministry picked up momentum, people in Ephesus, another major city in the Roman Empire, in the Greek world of the Roman Empire, they thought, and true, that a lot of people were getting rid of idolatry, that their great idol, in the King James, it's Diana. That's another version of Astarte, the same thing with different names. Or Artemis is another translation of the same name. They thought people would stop using their temple. And so they got a mob in the city, and they screamed for 2 hours, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." Think about that over and over. That's a lot of emotional energy. I'm trying to get you to see the emotional attachment that existed in that world that we probably don't see it because it's different. But we'll try to show you that it could be possible for certain things in our world too. And remember, emotions often trump logic, how people feel about something. The feelings are, in many respects, more important than logic. You deal with people, you'll see more and more of that. So Paul is saying these people have an emotional attachment, and those Corinthians with knowledge who are puffed up need to be careful how we respond. Verse 9, "But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours," that means you're free to eat meat, offer to idols any way where you want to, because the idol is nothing. "This freedom, lest this liberty of yours becomes a stumbling block to those who are weak." For verse 10, "For if anyone sees you have knowledge, eating in the idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols?" And what he's saying is, what we think is, well, we know some of this to be true. We don't maybe know the exact layout. Some of these big temples had like kind of a terrace where they had restaurants. And normally a third of the meat went to the, you know, they burn up in the idols' cauldrons. A third of the meat went to the priest. And a third of it was free. I mean, left over. So they would sell that cheap to the butcher shops around them, or sell it cheap in the restaurant to get people to come, you know, before the idol. And imagine that was a great restaurant to get a great deal on lamb chops and probably meat, make worldly business deals. So some of the Corinthians with knowledge would go to the temple restaurant. It's a great meal. And, you know, that temple music and whatever they're shouting in the background, it doesn't mean a thing to me. I could care less about it. But Paul is saying some of the brethren who just came out of that, or maybe various situations, to them it means a lot more. Verse 11, "And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died." We have to assume that some of those people went back to paganism. Maybe they went, they saw, well, brother so-and-so is eating at the temple, I'll go eat there too. And he gets the heebie-jeebies and the feelings of the music and the temple prostitutes and the bread and the wine and whatever. And I guess there's certain fun in it, whatever it was, and they went back and lost their salvation. That's what Paul, that's the only way you could interpret that verse. And he says, don't put a stumbling block, even if you're right. And matter of fact, sometimes when you're right, you have to be real careful that you're not acting in an unloving way. Well, I'm right, and he's wrong, so I don't care what happens to him. And I think even when you're right, you have to be careful about putting a stumbling block in front of your brothers. I remember this happened to one man in the church. It maybe is a different situation, but not totally different. He said that, he called us. He was in the hospital, and after talking to him, he told me what happened. He said, well, you know, I realized that, alcohol and bars, okay to go to. It's okay to drink as long as you don't get drunk. So I went to one of the bars I used to go to back in the days when I drank too much. And I went in there and I wanted to witness to the bikers and the people in the bar and all that sort of thing. And that was not a good idea. He drank too much and he got hurt really bad. The only point I'm making is there are some people who need to stay away from bars. And some people, certain bars, everybody should stay away from. Depends on the atmosphere. Now, if you go to a pub in England, and we went to a pub in Germany on that trip and several in England. At least the people in Germany, they can drink a lot of beer without getting drunk. And they acted pretty nice. Same with the British pub, maybe less beer, but they act pretty nice. But there are a lot of bars in America I would not say any Christian should go into, even if you can drink. I mean, the Bible is not saying you can't drink. Maybe that's a modern-day example of it. And you wouldn't want to lure anybody into a bar who has a weakness for that, because you could lead to his going back to alcoholism and destruction, potentially. He didn't want them to violate their conscience. Paul even said, when you read, he said, if I have to go so far as to stop eating meat, I'll do that if necessary. Let's go to chapter 9. Now we're going to what Paul gave up. Chapter 9, verse 1. Am I not an apostle? Am I not free? Free means he's not working for somebody else. If you, this is the contextual thing. Have I not seen Jesus Christ, our Lord? Are you not my work in the Lord? In other words, to be a real apostle, you have to actually be an emissary from Christ. Paul said, I did that. And the fact that he started and founded all those churches is proof of his apostleship. There are people challenging his apostleship for various, most were bad actors trying to deceive people. Verse 4 and 5, do we not have a right to eat and drink? He's not saying he can't eat and drink. He means, Barnabas and some of the other assistants with Paul, don't we have a right to eat and drink at the expense of the Corinthian church? That's what he's saying. And he's saying, yes, I have that right. Verse 5. Do we have no right to take along a believing wife, as do the other apostles, the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Because probably Peter had gone through that territory because he traveled to the dispersed Jews in the area. So they probably saw Peter and his wife was there. And Peter got financial support from the churches. So they probably knew that. And Paul is telling them that he had that right to eat at their expense. But what Paul tells them in this book and in other parts of the New Testament letters, Paul gave it up so that he could best serve and not hinder the work. What existed in Paul's day, there were a lot of religious con men who came along with great religious ideas, and then the people would pay them, and it was a great religious con. Remember, Bibles weren't as available then. There were scrolls that had to be read in a synagogue, or a big church had to collect them. They were very expensive. And a lot of people couldn't read and write. It wasn't as common. In other words, it was probably easier to deceive people then than it is now. Although there are religious con men today, too, but that's another story. But it was a lot easier then. And I think Paul believed, and we have to assume he was correct, since he wrote all that New Testament material, that they'd be very suspicious of a Jewish religious con man. So he chose, in many cases, to not take a salary so the gospel could convert more people and he could get to them deeply. And we, based on all the churches, you know, as they said, he turned the world upside down. He was right. And so he supported himself. Think about it. Paul probably worked 70 to 80 hours a week, you know, 30 to 40 hours doing church work and probably holding Bible studies and meetings and visiting people. And then 30, 40 hours on a job as a tent maker or maybe whatever else he may have done. You know, that's pretty, you talk about personal sacrifice. That is personal sacrifice, right? Got your own job, but you're also doing the work. So chapter 9, look at verse 12. And here's what Paul says. If others, meaning other leading ministers, including Peter, if others are partakers of this right over you, that is to be paid a salary, are we not even more? Because Paul's one who founded the church. Nevertheless, we have not used this right, but endure all things, lest we hinder the gospel of Christ. In other words, he puts up with it because it helps spread the gospel. He didn't want to hinder the gospel. And he's telling them, if I give that up, you should give up eating meat in the idol's temple and other things that are hurting the weaker brethren. He was telling what he would sacrifice for God. I'm going to read two little corny stories that kind of make a point. This first is called Why Little Johnny Cried. After the christening of his baby brother in church, little Johnny cried all the way home in the back of the seat of the car. His father asked him what was wrong. And finally, the boy sobbed that the minister said he wanted this little baby brought up in a Christian home. And I want him to stay with us. He wanted to sacrifice because he knew they weren't a good Christian home. He wanted to sacrifice for the baby of the family. Well, here's another joke. These several men are foursome playing golf, and there's a road right near the golf course, and they see a funeral procession go by the golf course. And one man gets to attention, puts his hat over his heart, and bows his head as a funeral procession goes by. And one of the other members of the foursome says, "Wow, that is really nice and respectful of you. I'm a bit surprised you did that." And he says, "Well, that's the least I could do after 30 years of marriage." I know that's not an original joke, right? But I want to emphasize the word least. Least. That was the least he could do. Paul is actually telling them, do the opposite. Don't do the least you can do for the other people of the church or the spreading of the gospel. Sacrifice what you want, your rights, for other people. You know, don't do the least. Do the, well, what we might say was the, what you ought to do. Notice what Paul says in verse 27 of 1 Corinthians 9, verse 27. "But I," meaning Paul, "discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified or fall away." Now, by the way, if anybody says, once saved, always saved, Paul certainly didn't preach that. And this is not the only place he says that. What Paul is saying, he disciplines himself to help others and you know, keep his human nature in line. And so we should discipline ourselves to stay humble and to help others, as Paul is saying, and keep our human nature in line, too. 1 Corinthians 10. We're almost through the story, but got a few more verses to finish. 1 Corinthians 10, 12. "Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." What he's saying, those of you that are puffed up because you know that the idol is nothing, you have a lot more knowledge, that arrogance can cost you your salvation. You get, you think because you're so smart, you get in a bad attitude, you get puffed up. And, you know, this is true of all of us. We know things that a lot of people in the world don't know. I mean, they're probably greater than us in many respects of character and background, had better parents, you know. And I'm not in any way saying we're better than others, but I'm saying we know that we know things that others don't know. And that can puff us up and then set you up for spiritual downfall. And Paul was warning the knowledgeable Corinthians to be careful. 1 Corinthians 10, 19 and 20. And we need to be careful too. Stay humble in spite of what we know. 19 and 20. Because we don't know it because we're better. We know it because God has called us. 10:19. "What am I saying then? That an idol is anything, or what is offered to idols is anything?" Of course he isn't saying that. "Rather, the thing which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to have fellowship with demons." And I remember Sharon Snyder used to always say, "Demonstrations." And you see some of these demonstrations, some on college campuses, especially at night, and you think of that term, demonstration. So what was going on at the temple of Aphrodite and of Mercury and of Zeus and Neptune? You know, a certain amount of demonic influence. Now, maybe there was no God there, and there's no real God they're worshiping, but maybe around that area there's demonic stuff. We were talking last night about dancing, and it is clear that the Bible has no prohibition against dancing. David danced, and however, you could make this argument that there are certain nightclubs, at least in many big cities, that I would tell any Christian to avoid, especially at night. As the night gets later and later, it gets worse. You almost, well, I don't say you know, but there's a high likability that a certain, especially young people, will be taking drugs like ecstasy, and maybe over half will be on marijuana. And as they don't really dance with partners so much. It almost looks pagan. They're jumping around to heavy beat music and drugs. You almost know there's got to be bad, evil influences in there. You know, most of those places have to have heavy security to keep from fights breaking out. Even that ought to tell you something. The point is that while it's free, dancing is okay with God. There are a lot of places you wouldn't want to go dancing in. And Paul is telling them there are places that they should avoid because of demonic influence. Verse 21, 1 Corinthians 10. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the Lord's table and the table of demons. You just can't mix the two. There are certain places you should avoid. So he's telling them, do not be in that restaurant on the wings of the pagan temples. Just don't be there. That's what Paul is saying. Even though you may have a legal right, Paul is saying, give it up like I gave up a salary. Verse 23. All things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but not all things edify. In other words, there may not be a law against going to this restaurant, but it's not going to build people up and put them at risk. Same with dancing in certain nightclubs, I'd say. There may not be a specific law in the Bible against it, but there are certain places that are just not likely to be a good influence on us. Verse 24. Let no one seek his own, but each one the other's well-being. And that is the whole point of this chapters 8, 9, and 10. Don't just think of yourself, even if legally you could say, the Bible has no prohibition against it. There's nothing against it. We should think of other people's welfare. Think of other people's welfare. Verse 24. And we should have an attitude of saying, let's protect the weaker members of the church. Try to avoid getting in fights and arguments that divide the church. And here I'm going to, this is a real ticklish area, so I say it's ticklishly. Even if you're right. Now, obviously, you don't want to allow false doctrine in the church, and there are some limits to that. But we don't have to fight with everybody over everything. And you can, for the sake of unity and love, you can kind of be a little nicer to some people than maybe you might feel you ought to be. But I'm not saying false doctrine. I got to be careful. I'm not taking it out of context. But not seeking your own, thinking about the other person's welfare. I remember the Andy Griffith Show, and this may not be the perfect example, but there were times when Barney was doing this and that and the other, and Andy would try to be bigger in a character sense than some of the others. He would let them think they're right or do what they're going to do just for the sake of harmony and happiness, and so Barney wouldn't realize what a jerk he really was. But I always liked that about the show. You know, as corny as it sounds, Andy Griffith was bigger than he had to be in character. I think that's what Paul is saying. Think of other people first. Be bigger in character than you have to be. And if there are weak brethren around you, kind of put up with a little bit of their weakness within reason. Obviously, you can say, what if they say, you can't do this, you can't do that, and it gets outrageous? Well, that's a different story. But you don't want to put them in any spiritual risk. So kind of bend over backwards and help them out. Verse 25, he says, eat whatever is sold in the meat market, asking no questions for conscience sake. I remember my son used to say, don't ask him if there's yeast in there. We don't want to know. Don't ask him. Because he wanted to eat the... But anyway, maybe that's another example. Don't ask him. We find out, we won't be able to eat it. But I do know what Paul meant. Paul said, don't worry about it. If someone serves you some lamb chops that they got from the local markets. And also this issue comes up in Rome, which probably was a bigger city with even more, at least in some ways, even more pagan temples. It's probably even harder to check the meat supply in Rome. But it's probably tough in Corinth, too. And, you know, if you go to a butcher in Corinth and you say, I want a leg of lamb that you can certify has not been before one of these pagan temples, what do you think the butcher's going to say? These crazy people. Yeah, that one over there. And they probably realize he doesn't care. He's not keeping track of that. He doesn't know. No one can be certain. A lot of them are afraid to eat anything. So how do I know? The butcher's going to tell me whatever I want to hear, probably. Are you all, you folks crazy? I just want the business, you know. So they couldn't know. Paul says, don't ask that question. Don't worry about it. The idol is nothing, whether that lamb chop was in that temple or not. Now, unless they did something weird to it, you know, like left a whole bunch of blood in it, because you're not supposed to eat a lot of blood. But assuming they drained it and cooked it, and, you know, reasonable, or whatever they were supposed to do to it, there's no reason not to cook it and eat it. That's what Paul is saying. Don't ask. Don't look for stuff to get picky about. Like, you know, some people get real picky about things. And actually, even when you go into 1 Corinthians, Romans 14, and some other books of the Bible, the picky people were the ones that Paul called the weak Christians. We often think that the ones who are the pickiest are the strongest. That's not how Paul, if you read what he says, the ones that are vegetarian because they're afraid of meat, Paul tells the Romans, they're the weak brethren. I know that's kind of the opposite of what we think. The ones that are picky are the weak ones. And Paul is just telling them, go easy on the weak brethren. It's going to take them a while to grow out of that, whatever you might call it. So don't ask any questions for conscience sake. For the earth is the Lord and the fullness. Everything there God made, and we shouldn't worry about it. Verse 28. But, here's the but. But if anyone says to you, this meat was offered to idols, do not eat it. You're going to say, wait a minute. You just said it doesn't matter. Yes, that's true. It doesn't matter. But if they make an issue of it, if they bring it up and they make an issue of it, this meat was offered to Diana or whatever, you know, the goddess of the Ephesian statue or the Zeus or Mercury. Do not eat it for the sake of the one who told you and for conscience sake. For the earth is the Lord's and its fullness. And so, in a sense, he's saying, we don't have to worry about the meat, but you have to worry about their conscience. And that kind of opposite. I got to worry about their conscience and their spirituality? Yes. You got to worry about them. And if you have to give up a great lamb chop meal, they'll realize, this guy does not eat meat offered to idols, and he's a real strong church member. Maybe I shouldn't do it. You set the example, and that example will help them. Now, you might later explain, we don't have to worry about whether meat's offered to idols or not, but if they are worried about it and they know for sure that it was offered to an idol, you won't eat it for their sake. And so Paul's point is, think of others, not yourself. Be like Paul. He gave up years of salary. And that's not easy to do, traveling in foreign countries, to help the gospel spread and to serve others. What an example. And if you read 2 Corinthians, there are several chapters in there where Paul told the Corinthians who were being undermined by bad leaders all that he sacrificed for the gospel. You think, wow. I mean, that's really impressive. Not just no salary, but also many other things he went through. Verse 33, the concluding verse. Paul says, just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit. And he meant that both in a dollar and a cents manner and also convenience manner. Not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many, that they may be saved. And a lot of people were probably saved more than maybe otherwise, because the Apostle Paul thought of other people first. And we should try to be big like that and think of other people first as well. We're going to forego another song. That's okay.